Good afternoon to you. This is Sheila Fogarty on 5 Live. With me are Roger Klein, the co-director of Campaigning Whistleblowers Network, Patients First. Whistleblowing in the NHS is what we're talking about for the rest of the half hour. Jenny Fessett is here too, who was a senior nurse at an NHS walk-in centre, Centres Plural, in Manchester, was a whistleblower and was moved from her post and now involved in campaigning to support nurses and doctors who have blown the whistle. And joining us are Helaney Donnelly, who was awarded an OBE, you might remember, after she spoke out about serious failings in care at Stafford Hospital when she was an A&E nurse there. We are now all very familiar with it, in large part because of the work that she and others did. And also with us is cardiologist Dr. Raj Mattoo, who was unfairly dismissed after raising concerns about patient safety. Good afternoon to both of you as well, and thanks for sticking around, Jenny and Roger. Before we go any further, I really want to hear from you as well, 850-58, but I just need to correct something that we said earlier on. When you log on to the Department of Health website to make a complaint or to raise a concern, Nick Garnett, who we spoke to earlier on, was talking about needing to leave contact details, name and number. It's actually optional now to leave your name and number when contributing to the review. This is a review being carried out by Sir Robert Francis, and there are 3 weeks left during which you can actually give him information and give him your view, your experiences. So just wanted to clarify that on air. So if somebody is listening and thinking they will contact the Sir Robert Francis review, don't be put off. It is entirely optional to provide any contact details when you contribute. So Roger Klein and Jenny Fessett, we were talking just a moment ago about a culture of bullying, about fear that still pervades. Jenny, you talked about your experience. Let me bring in cardiologist Dr. Raj Mattoo now. You won a 13-year case, Dr. Mattoo, against University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust in April this year. Tell me something about that process. What happened to you?
Good afternoon, Sheila. Yes, it took 13 years, the prime years of my career and life from me. In essence, I raised concerns with the hospital management about the fact that patients were regularly put at risk and not provided optimal or best care. The response, as Jenny has told you, in her experience, is something I've experienced from speaking to hundreds of other whistleblowers who've sought my advice. There's a pattern of behaviour. There's a deliberate attempt to falsify allegations against the whistleblower, to discredit them and to try and isolate them as quickly as possible. And that's been confirmed to me, ironically, very recently after I won my case by a manager in the West Midlands Strategic Health Authority, who confirmed that when they're trained, they have sessions where directors of HR tell them to do that. And what they do is this deliberate attempt to distract attention from the safety problem, which is, after all, why all of us whistleblower, we're concerned so much about our patients and their safety that we feel we have to speak up, because we can't, our morals and our obligations don't allow us to continue accepting it, is that they then try and very quickly create this attempt to smear you. And then what becomes the main issue in the public eye and in the eyes of the agencies that are supposed to regulate our trust is the employment dispute they've artificially created. And as you say, it took me 13 years to clear my name, to be vindicated, and for being credited at last for properly and appropriately raising concerns about safety. And I'll give you an example of why it remains a serious issue today. Is one of the things I raised concerns about was an overcrowding policy in Coventry, where five patients were placed into bays designed only for four. 5 years after I had raised this in the West Midlands in Coventry, I discovered only 3 weeks ago that it continued at Mid-Staffs Hospital and patient deaths occurred. So I then discovered only a few weeks ago that all my efforts to raise these concerns appear to have been in vain, because managers not only decided to turn on me and attack me, but the patient safety issue that I had first raised seems to have been forgotten. And it commensurate with that is the fact that to date, neither myself nor the two senior nurses who raised those concerns about the patient we saw dying as a result of being overcrowded and the serious clinical incident when we submitted, we had still not to date been interviewed about the circumstances, and we are aware but the relatives of that patient have still not been advised.
So you say, just to be clear, because I will need to give this organisation the right of reply at some point in some way. Which trust are you saying is exactly the same as it was when you raised fears about safety, patient deaths related to safety? Your fears over time have been vindicated. You say it's still going on. Which trust?
No, I'm talking about the culture of lack of willingness to learn and to deal with safety issues, because they converted my whistleblowing into an employment issue.
No, I understand that, but, yep. But you seem to also be saying that people are dying in a particular trust because nothing has changed.
Well, I gave you an example. In Coventry, I raised this 5 years later in mid-staffs, overcrowding by the same managers who run Coventry and the mid-staffs in the same strategic area. The overcrowding was still taking place, and I discovered 5 weeks ago because a patient came forward on the BBC.
We'll get some response to them from that as to whether they regard it as being the case. And it's interesting what Raj has just raised there, Roger Klein. You say there is a direct correlation between good health outcomes in trusts and a good approach to whistleblowing, a good approach to safety.
There's a wealth of evidence from patient safety science that an open, transparent learning environment in which there isn't bullying is much, much better for patients. Why? Because people are more willing to admit they've made mistakes. They don't feel they'll be blamed. They're more able to raise concerns because they're welcomed for doing so. It's not just self-evident, but there's a heap of academic research demonstrating that what the best trusts do is best for patients. That's why we were formed, and that's why it's unacceptable that many trusts still haven't got the message.
Is it naive of me to have been absolutely horrified by Raj telling me that he's had confirmation that people are taken out and trained to do this kind of stuff?
Well, I've not heard that myself, but it doesn't altogether surprise me, because there is a shared pattern that people report to us in which raising a concern gets turned into attacking the member of staff. Not in all cases, of course.
It's as though they've been sent on a course.
Well, I couldn't say, but it certainly is as if there is a culture that in some cases says, don't deal with the problem, deal with the person.
Jenny?
I'd have to agree. Supported many, many nurses in all four countries in my role as lead nurse for Patients First, there is a pattern. There is a pattern of behaviour that you see from these NHS organisations is to ignore the concern, turn on the person raising that concern and make it an employment issue, and then remove that person from the organisation.
Well, I'm going to turn it on its head and say, are any of these people being removed from the organisation once it's established what they've been doing?
Well, that's
I'll start that campaign, shall I?
Well, by all means.
Thank you.
That's a very good question. At the Public Accounts Committee, very recently, Department of Health were asked if they could name anybody who'd been held to account for victimising whistleblowers, and they couldn't. So one of the things that Jeremy Hunt can do, we would hope, is to make it clear that if senior board members are found guilty of victimising whistleblowers, they must be held to account to send a message to the service.
Sacked.
I'm being a bit kind of cautious here, but they certainly must be held to account. It would depend on the circumstances. But what's not acceptable is that nobody has been held to account. The chief executive who victimised Raj is still in post in a different trust.
And you don't believe you'll get a job back, do you? A job in the NHS, do you, Raj?
No, in fact, that's true. The verdict of the tribunal in my case, was that they came to the view that, and quite rightly so, the NHS is a monopoly employer. And their view was that I would not work again as a consultant in the National Health Service. And I quite agree with it.
Why?
Unfortunately, many people have come to me, and there's evidence that, firstly, there is a form of listing. We could call it blacklisting if you want, but there is a list held by the Department of Health of certain types of clinicians that they would probably find disagreeable because they're too outspoken. And secondly, because it would be very difficult for me to persuade a trust to take a risk on taking me on when I have become de-skilled, need some reskilling, and also have over me this 13-year attempt to discredit and smear me. And I personally know if I was faced with a candidate who's come through untarnished and myself, it is most unlikely that I am going to be appointed. And so, in fact, the managers who do this to us know they are stigmatizing us. And it's very difficult to then, once you've had that done, to get rid of the stigma.
Were you compensated?
Well, we are due to have a remedy hearing to be told of what the compensation might be. That's due next year.
What might you do with your future?
I have to look at doing something entirely different, which to most clinicians, it's a way of life being a leading consultant. And it almost, after a while, starts to define you as a person. And it's been very difficult for me and my family to come to terms with the fact that everything I'd worked for since 18, so much of my life that I'd given up, it's devastating to come to the have to come to terms with the fact that I will no longer be able to look after people, which is what I set out to do at 18, and to be a doctor in the National Health Service.
Do you ever look at it this way, that by talking out like this and doing the work that you're clearly doing around your own case, you are saving people and helping people further down the line? You might never meet them, but you are.
I think we're on the road to it. I have belief in Jeremy Hunt and Simon Stevens, the new chief of the NHS. They're a breath of fresh air. They are the first in a 12 to 13 year case that I've had who have at least been receptive to and keen to make changes. I personally think my contribution in the end might be small, depends on what happens from here on in. But it could be big if the Department of Health was to engage with people like myself and other whistleblowers. But the culture is so deep-rooted, and only if changes are made, which isn't just a cultural change. I heard you ask the question earlier, can you make statutory introductions that make people speak up? I personally have huge reservations with that. I think it's a big mistake by those that are in charge. You cannot expect clinicians to do what I've had to do, and Felicity and others have done, is to put our careers at risk at the same time as not being able to assure us, first and foremost, if you speak up and we make it a legal obligation, that you'll be protected. You cannot legally force people to speak up. It just won't happen. And not only that, you're putting more people in danger, because I think that they need to fix the tail end first. They must protect first, okay. Then introduce the statutory right.
Helena Donnelly, I haven't forgotten you, I promise. To remind people of your past, you spoke out about serious failings in care at Stafford Hospital when you worked there as an A&E nurse, and you are now an ambassador for cultural change at the Staffordshire and Stoke-on-Trent Partnership NHS Trust, and an advisor to this review that we're talking about, the review by Sir Robert Francis. Can you reassure Dr. Raj Mathew in any way about his future? Because what he describes is a professional life shattered by doing his job well.
Yes, absolutely. And unfortunately, I don't think at this point anybody can reassure him or any other whistleblowers. But obviously, I think we can take heart from the fact that there is a shift beginning. As Raj points out, both Jeremy Hunt and Simon Stevens have been extremely engaging and really, I feel, genuinely wanting to listen to whistleblowers' experiences. And obviously, this is how we're now at the point of the Robert Francis review into whistleblowing, which is hopefully going to help identify and uncover some of the problems and help point us in the direction of where we need to go from here on in. And I would hope a huge part of that is that where people have genuinely raised concerns, they can, for those who it's already occurred, can hopefully come back into the NHS in some shape or another and can help continue with their careers and support others. And for the future, we can help prevent people from leaving the NHS in the first place simply because they've raised a concern.
Well, I know you're an ambassador in this instance, but and they're never sort of aggressive people ambassadors, are they? It's
not, it's, I hope not.
But do you think that there are people running trusts around this country, or not necessarily the guy or gal at the top, but there are people in senior positions in trusts across this country who who shouldn't even be in the NHS, given what they've done to people like Raj and to people like Jenny and potentially yourself.
Yes, absolutely. I'm relatively sure of it, really. I think there are far too many people still at the top of organisations, but as you point out, actually all the way through, some at the sort of front line and some certainly in those sort of middle management positions. And they are actually the ones who are potentially more harmful in the first instance, because they are the ones who are actively discouraging and bullying and preventing their colleagues and those who are working underneath them from raising genuine concerns, and they are the ones who are the most corrosive, actually, and doing the most damage before it's even got to the top levels.
Roger Klein, when they do that, the person, not the complaint thing, are they breaking the law? You know, endangering safety in a hospital, something like that?